Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. Thanks, everybody, for joining us for another of our special 12 days of the Comic Source episodes, bringing you some good cheer as we head toward the end of 2020. My guest today that I'm going to welcome on the show has extremely varied career, has done all kinds of everything in the entertainment industry, and we're gonna talk about it. It's such an interesting eclectic collections of things that he's done, and most recently you've heard me talking about his work on The Flash, which was a four issue arc, and it was wonderful. It was such a fun Flash centric nostalgic trip down memory lane for me, while still fresh with incredible art from Clayton Henry. So without further ado, I'd like to welcome Kevin Shinnick to the show. Kevin, thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for the kind words. I appreciate all that.
Yeah, whenever I find something that's as good as your Flash run, I have to shout it from the rooftops, because I want to be sure that people are picking it up, and it was so fun, and we're going to talk about it in a little bit. But the first time we have people on the podcast, we always want to start off with their secret origin of how they got involved with comics. And your career is so much more than comics, and I want to talk about that too. But let's give the comics the starting point here. Did you grow up reading them? How did you come to discover a joy of comics? What was kind of your gateway? How did you find your way into the wonderful world of comics?
You know, I have always loved comics, and I've always read them. And I can't remember how old I was, but it was young. And I got a copy of The Untold Legends of Batman, which was a Len Wein comic. And it was like a six-issue arc, but it involved this this theft of... In the story, anyway, Bruce Wayne's dad had a Batman costume that he wore to a Halloween party, and it gets stolen from the Batcave. And he's trying to figure out who could have possibly broken into the Batcave and stolen it. But in addition to this real-time theft, it's a flashback to how he became Batman, how all the villains became the villains. So within six issues, I was up to speed with Batman, loving it, and just desperate for my parents to be murdered in an alleyway, because it had everything I wanted, you know, and I was hooked from that moment on. And then, you know, then you just start to dig around and find who else is out there. And I think, looking back, I think my number one guy was Spider-Man, but after that, it was all DC. Mm. It was Batman and Flash and Superman. But yeah, I was heavily involved in comics, and really never gave it up. You know, I think I have every Batman comic from 1988 to 1998. And then I thought, well, that's a nice decade. Let's stop so I can, you know, have space to live in again.
Right.
But yeah, that's what really got me involved. And, you know, not to jump around, but you talk about my career, and it does jump around like it has the interest of a 10-year-old. And that's because I pursue the things that I've always enjoyed, and that started back when I was that age. And as a result, you know, I've made a career out of working for Spider-Man and Star Wars and Batman and Flash and Mad Magazine and all sorts of things. And it's been a great ride as a result.
Yeah, you're like living the dream, so to speak.
I've turned my midlife crisis into a career.
That's fantastic. I do want to touch on one other thing. You mentioned, you know, starting around the mid 80s. So that was really when it was kind of the dual distribution model that you know, no longer exists. Now everything is direct market, obviously, with the exception of the Walmart stuff and some Target stuff. So what, did you frequent a comic shop when you started collecting, or did you start off
Dad
did, where 7-Eleven, spinner rack kind of thing?
No, you know what it was? I mean, I had a candy store at the corner of my street growing up. Mm. And this is the 70s we're talking about.
Right.
I would go down and see what I can get off the comic book rack. But then also, you know, I would always go, and my dad would take me to, you know, old bookstores. And I still have one in mind. I grew up on Long Island. Mm. And it was just, you know, it was dusty and dank and filled. It was like a hoarder. And I would find the comics there. But then a great memory I have was, once a month I would make him take me to the it was my first comic book convention, but again, it was in the basement of the Coliseum Hotel on Long Island in Hempstead. And you know, in addition to the comics, I loved you know, the movie cards, you know, mm-hmm. everybody else was doing baseball cards. And I had all the series of Star Wars cards and the Superman cards and all of that. So I really, I love that. And then that was, like I said, growing up. And then high school, college, I'm from Merrick, Long Island, which is in New York. And there was L&S Comics just walking distance from my house. So I would go there and I'd, you know, get my lists filled every week. And then a great joy was many years later, only about 2 years ago, I can't remember what, I think it may have been a Star Wars thing I was doing, but online were the two guys who ran that shop. And they were like, oh my gosh, we're so happy for you. And I was shocked that they even remembered me because they have so many customers.
Right.
But I guess when you pull stuff for people each week, you see their name so often.
Mm-hmm.
So I was so happy to see Larry and I can't remember what the S was, but it was so sweet to see them and reconnect with them after all those years.
Yeah. You know, growing up in the era that we did, those kind of memories are so fun to think back on, especially because for me, it was a little corner market, you know,
right
by my grandparents' house. And, you know, they had the comic section and all the magazines, and you would just go to that corner of the store. And I'm sure it's the same way at the old book store that you went to, you would just get that smell of newsprint.
Yeah.
Right. And it just brings those memories flooding back.
It totally does. And also, you know, I love thinking back. I hadn't thought about it till we talked about it now. Those cards, those movie cards, you know, they had what? I don't know how many, 10 in a pack. Mm-hmm. And then you'd get most of them. You'd only need like maybe three more, but you couldn't guarantee. So you just kept buying them, hoping the one you needed would be in there. And so that's why whenever we went to the comic book convention, I would make the hard sell to my dad, because they would have them for sale complete. Mm-hmm. And I mean, look, in the long run, it's going to save us money because I'm getting them all in one. And I usually convinced them. So that was always a good memory.
Yeah. Plus, then you're not ruining your teeth with that gum that would, exactly. If you dropped it on the ground and it shattered, you could like cut your foot on it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Sharp. So from there, from a love of story and character and everything, you made a career. Did you go to school thinking that you were going to be a writer and be a creator of stories? I know you have acting in your background. Did you think you were going to take that route, or did you just kind of throw caution in the wind and say, I'm not sure, and I'm just going to see where the path takes me?
No, you know, I came out of the womb knowing I was going to be an entertainer. Now, for many, many years, I thought that was going to be solely as an actor, and I'm still an actor and I do television work and stuff. But at some point in my career, I mean, I went to college for a drama was my major, as well as communications and things. And I was very fortunate. About a year after college, I got my first Broadway play. And then subsequently I did like six other Broadway shows. So I had a good Broadway career run for a bit. And then, you know, you get to a point where I think a lot of actors at a point like, I need to write my own stuff, or I want to get my voice out there, you mm-hmm. know? And the funny thing is, it's such an, you know, people ask me, how do you break in and stuff like that? No one has the same story because there is no formula.
Right.
I was doing this one man show and I took these Broadway producers, or they took me out to lunch to discuss possibly doing it someplace else. And literally, as we're getting our coats on to leave, having discussed everything already, they said, oh, by the way, you don't know anything about Spider-Man, do you? And I was like, what are you, I was the biggest Spider-Man fan. I was like, and you know, again, comic books at the time, you know, maybe you don't want to scare people off with how much you enjoy them.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah, why? And they were like, well, we have the rights to do the very first feature length theatrical performance of Spider-Man. Now this was 10 years before Julie Taymor did hers,
mm-hmm.
but they said, would you like to take a crack at, you know, coming up with an idea? And I was like, are you kidding me? Especially having come from Broadway, you know, it was all my worlds coming together. So I wrote and then wound up directing what became the very first feature length adaptation of Spider-Man on the stage. And it played at Radio City Music Hall. And then it toured the country, like 40 different cities. And it was a big hit for us. And it was really such a wonderful thing that, you know, it was Spider-Man. And I it's so funny because I don't know if it directly led to me doing comics, but I'm sure it didn't hurt. Because mm-hmm. what happened then was, you know, things shift. I was in New York. My wife is also a writer and producer. Came out here to California, and I got hooked up with a show called Robot Chicken. And those guys became fast friends, and I wrote some superhero sketches. And then I remember meeting my DC, which would then became my DC editor, Mike Seglain, at Comic-Con. And he was like, oh, you did a Batman sketch that I loved on Robot Chicken. And we shared some stories. And he said, well, if you ever want to write a Batman story, and I was like, don't joke. You can't just toss that out casually. And so we talked, and that was my first thing. My first contribution to comics was a 10-page story to the Batman 80-page giant, I think, in 2009. And then, you know, it just kind of, once people know you're interested and once you've kind of proven yourself a little bit, the same thing happened. I had turned Mad Magazine into an animated sketch comedy show on Cartoon Network. And someone from Marvel met me at Comic-Con and said, you know, my family's a big fan of Mad. And I'm like, well, I'm a big fan of Spider-Man. And sure enough, they were like, well, come write for us. And so that's kind of how it happens, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not, nothing's guaranteed. You know, you've got to prove yourself. But even when you do, nothing's always coming at you fast and furious. Sometimes they drop off. I mean, you know, behind the scenes, everybody's struggling. You know, everybody's overworked. You know, if it's out of sight, out of mind. So it takes everything you can to stay relevant and stay on their call sheet.
Yeah, what's so interesting to me, you know, here you're, you know, doing all this television work, obviously the Broadway stuff that you mentioned, both on the stage and behind the scenes producing things. And I think people don't necessarily realize, people that aren't writers especially, how much work goes into that, right? So to do that, and then also, yeah, you can contribute, you can, you know, kind of live your dream and write some of these stories once in a while. But in order to do something, you know, month in, month out, and do it consistently, I'm sure to the level that you would want to, it's so much work. It's so hard to juggle those things. So do you try to fit in the comics when you can? Do you think there may be a time when you focus more on that and then do try to do a longer run?
You know, I'm always open for the comics. That is kind of like my happy place. You know, you talk about childhood. My wife and I always joke that my childhood was in the summer coming home from the pool and then sitting in my room with the air conditioner on, just reading my comics. You know, I go there for a happy place. Mm-hmm. So I will always say yes to the comics when they come to me. But I always try and make sure it's something that I feel I can contribute to. And if I don't necessarily think that on the when first invited to do so, I find a reason to, or find what my in is. Mm-hmm. Getting back to what you said before, I think it's great because it inspires people. Whatever inspires you is wonderful. And a lot of time the inspiration comes from, hey, I could do better than this guy or this gal. And that's fair, you know, but I think, because it's all, you know, opinion anyway, but I think what it comes down to is not just can you do something better or what you think is better, but can you do it under the parameters that are asked? Because what people don't realize is how overworked a lot of these editors are, how there's very little communication, or they'll come to you in the 11th hour and say, oh, we need these major changes in the next half hour. And you're like, what? Yep. You know, and it's like all these things that contribute to the challenge of doing these things. So I'm always so pleased when I get a great response from a comic, because I know what all the work that has gone into it, not just from what I'm doing, but from everybody's point of view, the colorist, the artist, the editor, the assistant editor, everybody.
Yeah, it's such a collaborative process. And I want to talk about that a little bit. But before we get to that, talk to me a little bit about the different headspace you have to get into, how different it is writing for a comic versus, I mean, it's still a visual medium, just like television is or Broadway, but so different. And for that matter, you know, Broadway and television is very different. You know, doing something in front of a live audience plays much different than on television. So is a different headspace? Does it exercise different writing muscles, these different mediums?
It does, but I have to say, I always start from the same place, which is as the audience member or the reader or whoever my target is. Because I want to be entertained just as much. Kevin Shinnick, the reader, wants to be just as entertained, you know, when I'm reading Kevin Shinnick, the writer. And I think I'm the hardest on myself because I, again, like I said to you, I only want to do this if I can contribute something that I think is worthy of it. And if I don't have that idea first, I will work super hard to get to the point where, all right, now I'm interested. Now I feel I have something to say. And you're right. It's kind of an art form into itself, but it's almost to me like a little puzzle. How do I get a great story in 20 pages without going over 6 or 7 panels a page, without having too much dialogue? You know, I mean, that's the gist of comics, really. And can I still, can I keep the excitement of the page turn? And can I, you know, do the best comic I can under those parameters? So that alone is a challenge, but I rise to it. I get excited by that, you know? So when I read other comics, I'm always, my hat's off to people who do that. And sometimes I'm critical too, if I'm like, all right, well, you know, this is a little wordy. Even to myself, sometimes I'll go back to earlier comics and be like, okay, this could have been a little tighter here or whatever. But that's where I start with what I want to see. And as I just broke down what I looked for in a comic, I do the same thing with each medium. You know, if it's an animated show, you know, without saying too much, I'm working on an animated Christmas special for someone right now. There are certain parameters you want to see. You know, you don't want a lot of talkie in this. You don't want a little this, that. You know, I wrote a Star Wars novel last year. You do get to write more wordy there because that's what it is. And that's the medium. People want to lose themselves in that minutia of that medium. So it does change depending on what you're working on and what medium you're working on. But for me, it starts from the same place always. What do I have to say? And is it interesting enough?
Yeah, and all these different mediums, you know, we were just talking about collaboration. They have different levels of collaboration. Certainly comics, like you said, can depending on your editor, can be very isolated where you're not getting much feedback until that 11th hour when they
exactly.
As opposed to Broadway, which I imagine is very collaborative, and television as well. So can you talk a little bit about how that's different for each medium?
Totally. You know what's so funny? I'm trying to think, like, I was thinking the other day if this is true, because, you know, you have revisionist history of your experiences with things. But in some ways, like the novel, I did a Star Wars novel last year called Star Wars Force Collector, which did very well for me. And it was a great experience. I'll tell you some funny stories that go along with it, but overall, it was a great experience. And it probably is the medium that you get to explore most, because other than you and the editor, that's it. You know, there's not many other people weighing in. With Lucasfilm in particular, they have, out of necessity, and I think a lot of companies should have this, what's called a story group. 6 or so people who know everything that's going on across all platforms, video games, movies, comics, novels, everything. So the story that was funny was I pitched them this novel and it took them about a year to greenlight it. And then when they finally did, they said, it's greenlit. I was like, fantastic. And they were like, okay, we need it in 3 months. And I said, what? No, it may be misunderstood. I mean, like a 90,000 word novel. They were like, yeah, so do we. And I was like, I said, that's impossible. Forgetting, of course, that's exactly what Luke says to Yoda in Empire. And I was like, oh, I'm eating my own words here. So this was about a year before Episode 9 comes out, Rise of Skywalker. So you're writing in a vacuum because it's, you know, they're not sharing what's happening in that world at all. So I kill myself and I get them a draft, honestly, probably about 4 months. And so I'm happy, I hand it in. And then it was Christmas about 2 years ago, right before Christmas, they called me and they said, well, something's happened that we didn't foresee happening. And I said, what? They said, well, somehow without knowing it, you inadvertently wrote a big section of Episode 9. And I was like, you're kidding. I said, well, you got me on the wrong gig. I should be writing the movies then. And we all laughed. And then they were like, yeah, anyway, you got to rewrite yours. And I was like, oh, you're kidding me. So that was, other than that, you know, working in that medium, it's pretty much like it's you and the page. With comics, you have the joy of having an artist bring it to life. And, you know, all I know is how I work. And that is, each script I write for comic is almost a letter to the artist. Like, hey, Will, I'm thinking here, this is what I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. But you hope and expect that they will come back and either plus that or say, I don't see how this is happening. I have a better idea. And you can collaborate and say, oh, great, great. You know, in television, you got a lot more people weighing in. You know, you've got producers and networks and all sorts of stuff. So you have to wait a couple more times for rounds of notes and things. But it's all, you know, that it's all a different experience, but they're all great. You know what I mean? I mean, to be able to, as stressed as I get sometimes, I created that Spider-Man series, which is called just Marvel Spider-Man on Disney XD. And there were times, again, because deadlines are so tight and turnaround is so tight, that I'd be stressed. And then I'd sit there and be like, all right, Kev, think for a second. You're writing Spider-Man for a series you created for television. Right. Go back and explain that to 10-year-old Kev. And it's like, yeah, what I got to enjoy this. And I think a lot of what I do does well because I think you feel the enjoyment on the page. And I'm not writing this because it's not coming from resentment. It's not coming because it's a job I have to do. I'm treating it because I'm the luckiest person in the world to do it. And I think sometimes if I do my job right, that comes across.
Yeah. And I'm curious too, because you've been showrunner on some things and producer. When you're in that role, is that something you try to convey to everybody when they get stressed out? You know, hey, we're all pulling in the same direction here, and if we do our job right, we're going to catch lightning in a bottle. But let's remember, we're also here to have fun.
I do every chance I get. I've had a number of people tell me that I'm very zen in the room, and it's not. I don't go out of my way to be zen, but I think that's just my philosophy. It's like, look how lucky we are. You know, and yeah, we're always going to have issues when they call the 11th hour and say we need all these changes. But to be able to do what we do, and who knew all those years ago, you know, we talked about it, but it's like that comic books were, you know, not rare, but everybody didn't love them. And now it's everywhere. It's everywhere. And that was one of the challenges, again, going back to what can I say that hasn't been said before. When I was doing the Star Wars novel, I thought Star Wars is everywhere. How can any of this be fresh? And then it dawned on me that we probably know more about Star Wars, the Star Wars, than the people who live in that galaxy. Yeah. Because I try to think of it like, look at our own history. We all know about World War I, World War II, the Civil War. We know who won and who lost, but there's so much we don't know. And then you get a story like Dunkirk or Schindler's List or Glory, and you're like, oh my God, there's so much I don't know about these things. So I tried to, my main character in Force Collector is this young kid who gets these massive headaches when he touches certain objects that he doesn't know why, but right before he passes out, he sees a vision of that object's past. And his grandmother basically says, like, I think you have the Force, you just don't know how to use it. And he's like, I don't even know what that is, you know, because he's on the outskirts of the outer rim of the galaxy. You picture he's in like, you know, some, you know, not great school where the history books aren't fantastic. So she explains to him everything she can. And he's like, well, if all the Jedi are dead, who's going to train me?
Right.
Like, well, let life be your master. Go out and find objects to touch and see what they can inform. And that's what that story is about. But it's kind of like, what can I bring to that? I was bringing my experience of discovering Star Wars when I was 7 to a new kid who lived in that galaxy. And I think it was the perfect book, because people said it was like the perfect book for those who knew everything about Star Wars and for those who knew nothing about Star Wars. Because while the story was an original story about this kid learning about his world, every time he touched an object, we flash back to one of the great moments or moments that we loved from any one of the movies, cartoons, or comics.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you're writing one story, but really you're pulling from everywhere, which absolutely. When it comes to Star Wars, you sort of have to do that.
Yeah, exactly. It's like Mandalorian. You know, at this point, it's in a great way. It's, you know, action scene, Easter egg, great guest star, and plot evolution. Yep. You know what I mean? But it all works.
Yeah, and again, it's a celebration. And as a creative, you know, behind the scenes, like you yourself said, when you're passionate, when you're having fun, that comes through on the page. And then, you know, us on the other side, we can see that. We can see when somebody's just phoning it in and when somebody's really having fun doing what they're doing.
Absolutely. And the other trick, though, is, and I learned this with the novel, you know, you can't, as much as I said, I want to be interested in as myself as the reader, it can't be so insulated, meaning I know so much about Star Wars. but I'm not writing a novel for me. Right. I'm writing a novel for an audience. And I want people to be able to pick this up and not have to know as much as I know about Star Wars to enjoy this. And yet for the people who do, there's plenty in there that they can be like, oh, this guy knows what he's doing. And that's kind of how I felt with Flash. Dan, I mean, this goes back a little bit how I got involved. Dan DiDio had called me to come in to possibly work on some projects there. And then obviously, you know, there was a whole shakeup over there. Mm-hmm. And things fell through. They got moved around. But anyway, the team came back to me and said, would I be interested in doing Flash? But they posed it by saying, look, everything that's ever been done has been done in Flash. Do you want to take a crack at it? And I was like, well, that's quite a challenge, but yeah, I don't want to turn that on. I said, give me about a week to figure this out. And then I thought, like we said, what did I love about the Flash? He was one of my go-to guys. And, you know, I grew up loving Barry Allen. Mm-hmm. I know most people are now Wally West because he was around for so long. But what made Barry so special to me was not only his sense of hope, but also that ring. I loved that ring as a kid. And so, and you know, I love Silver Age. So I put my head to the grindstone. I was like, or actually my nose, I guess, would go to the grindstone. But I tried to figure out what can I offer that hadn't been done. And I thought, what do I know? What do I don't know about that ring? And so when I hooked into a story that I really was happy for myself, like as a reader, like, oh, that would be cool if I found that out. I did that. And then in the same way, I tried to make it exciting for people who have been around for, you know, the last 60 years of Flash, but also the people who haven't read him in a while. You know, I want you to be able to pick mine up and be like, oh, you know, comic books I pick up, well, I'm like, I don't know what's going on here. It's going to take too long to get in.
Yep.
But I wanted to give it a little simplicity, at least that first issue. And then I wanted to kind of hook you in and then bring out the big guns. And like I said, a little flavor of Silver Age, because that's what I loved and that's what interested me, and other stuff that a story that you could sink your teeth into.
Yeah. And you succeeded spectacularly. I mean, when I was the first issue, I wasn't quite sure. Not to be honest, I was like, oh yeah,
yeah.
Trying to understand, see what he's doing here. But I didn't know it was a part of a larger arc. By the time the second issue, I read the second one, I'm like, oh, I'm in 100% because I'm a Barry Allen guy too. And the thing that you did that was so great was that not only were you adding to the mythos with the ring, paying homage to what's come before, is like you said, it wasn't tied into anything else going on in the DCU. So that just made it feel instantly classic.
Right.
You know, could fit in any time of Barry Allen's Flash career. You could be telling this story. You brought in Rogues, which is great. That's always going to make it feel, you know, very classic. But not only did you bring in Rogues, not only did we see, the Trickster and Dr. Alchemy, you leveled Dr. Alchemy up. You raised the stakes, and it just felt so nostalgic to me of that golden era of Barry Allen. You hit a home run.
Well, I appreciate that. I really do, because, you know, you hope for that when you're working on it, but you never know, you know, it goes out and sometimes, and again, what's kind of a frustrating thing is the writer is never the last one to take a pass at the script. And sometimes it's frustrating. And I honestly sometimes don't read my stuff after it comes out because I don't want to know what was omitted or changed or condensed, because I work so hard on every word of that than to have them paraphrase or something. You're like, but like I said, I don't go out of my way to read reviews, but sometimes good vibes come back to me. And on this one, they certainly did. So I was very grateful. And thank you. Thanks to you, too, for being so kind with your words.
Yeah, I did want to ask you about that. I know I wasn't the only one talking about the issues, but fan reaction, fans of Barry Allen, fans of Flash, to a man, they pretty much seem to enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was very pleased. Like I said, I've got nothing but positive feedback from many sources. Which is just, you know, I couldn't be happier, because as I joke, I work a lot in IP, so I'm always ruining somebody's childhood somewhere. and what I find funny is the only thing which I find hilarious, which is I wrote what I like to consider the Citizen Kane of all Scooby-Doo movies, Scooby-Doo meets Kiss. Mm. And I say that jokingly, but for some reason, as I said, you're always ruining someone's childhood. That movie hits the bullseye. Everybody seems to love that movie, and I'm so happy. And maybe the bar was so low, maybe the expectation was so low, but what I find, because I do a lot of these, in addition to Comic-Cons, I do a lot of these KISS conventions now. And what I find is that our generation or whomever is so desperate for their kids to like KISS that this was the perfect crossover to introduce them and make mom and dad and the kids all happy with one movie.
That's awesome. I did not know that that existed. My wife's a huge Scooby-Doo fan. I'll have to see if I can get her to watch it.
Oh, you have to. You have to.
I'll let you know. It was kind of
great. But yeah, again, that I was so happy with Flash because he meant so much to me growing up that I wanted to do him do justice. And I've been very pleased with the response.
Yeah. And like I said earlier, you had some great artists on the book with you, Clayton Henry and then Will Conrad.
Yes.
What was the collaboration like with those two? You know, they're veterans of the comic industry. You know, they're working month in, month out. And here you are kind of popping in for a 4-issue arc. Was there anything that any advice they gave you or did you guys just kind of hit the ground running and gel right away?
We just kind of hit the ground running. I think on these timelines, there's very little time for let's have coffee and chat about the character.
Right.
You know what I mean? But that being said, I think we are all at a level where it's second nature to us.
Mm.
So it's not like we're reinventing the wheel in terms of the process. They were all great. As I said to you before, I thought it really worked to my advantage because Clayton was supposed to be on for the whole run, but then I think they needed him to go on to the next, big event happening, which is I think Flash is going to. And so then I got Will, who was also phenomenal. And in a way, and Sam also contributed artwork as well. So what was interesting to me was I had always intended, as I said before, for that first issue to feel like a standalone one story.
Mm-hmm.
And then only later do the stakes get higher and you realize, oh, the seeds of Flash's problems were planted in that first issue.
Right.
So in some ways, I was happy that Clayton's look kind of, and his style kind of worked with Trickster very well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then the further we got from that issue and the further of a threat that Alchemy becomes, I thought Will's art really kind of brought it home and made it a little more severe, which I loved. And what's funny is, you know, you have these grand ideas in your head like, oh, I'll come up with this one shot and people will think it's a one shot and they won't know where it's going. And then you look on the internet and you realize the solicitation was like, and after that, Dr. Alchemy. And you're like, oh, that was going to be a surprise. Yeah. You know what I mean? All this stuff. And you get that, you forget they need to market these. They need to do all that. But I called the editor. I was like, wait a second. This solicitation was like, there's no one who could live up to this. First of all, there was one that said like, you'll never guess the ending. And I was like, now you're just overselling this. I said, and secondly was you make it sound like, I mean, you know, Joshua was on for 4 years. You've given me 4 issues. You make it sound like I'm the next guy for the next millennium, you know?
Right.
And while I would love to be, I said, that's not the agreement we had. And so they were like, oh yeah, I'm sorry about that. But I did say to them like, you know, what is the history of this? And it's still up in the air as everything is in comics and DC and Marvel and all that. But they did say to me, there is a possibility of, if not jumping back on the Flash, jumping on something. So I'm hoping, you know, we stay in the rotation here.
Yeah, well, I'd love to see you do more work and at DC or Marvel for that matter, and kind of bring that sensibility because I love what you're doing here. It's very similar to things. Another one of my favorite writers, who's actually a personal friend, Robert Venditti. You guys have a very similar approach where you're looking back at the history and you're pulling in things from the past, which kind of pays off for, you know, longtime fans like
yes.
myself,
yes.
But you're being respectful of what's come before, but you always manage to, even with the hundreds of stories that have been told with these characters, you manage to keep it fresh. Doing that also makes it more new reader friendly.
Yeah. Well, truth be told, you know, with all due respect to everyone who's written, I haven't been up to date with Flash also, continuously for the last 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I couldn't, there was no way I could catch up on all of that. And I thought that was almost to my advantage. So I thought I don't want to get accidentally or subconsciously sucked into what existed already. And as I said to you, I wanted this to be a starting off point. So who better to start off than me, who wasn't quite sure, right, you know, where, what we had to stay true to in the past.
Yeah, that's so great. And again, Kevin, I really enjoyed it, and we'll look forward to seeing if there's more flash work or something else.
Absolutely.
I do want to ask you, you know, you mentioned being an actor, and probably the gig that most people may know you from is Carmen Sandiego, the show on CBS. That's right. And you have your own action figure. I have to ask you about that. What is that like, having your own action figure?
That's pretty amazing, but it's a little, it wasn't mass produced action figure. It all came about because when I was working on Robot Chicken, you talk about the quota of sketches you've got to come up with in a one day period is almost ridiculous. And I was grabbing from all sources. And then I thought, well, I think the first sketch I got in was a Carmen Sandiego sketch. I thought, let me write for what I know.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a sketch involving Carmen Sandiego. And I remember Seth Green, who's one of the creators, was like, oh my God, how do you remember that show? And I was like, because I was the host of that show. And his jaw just dropped. He's like, no. And so we created these action figures for the sketch and for, you know, the puppetry and stuff. And so there's a few of them that exist now. And I have one. I think they still have one in case they ever go back to that. But yeah, it's pretty amazing. It is pretty amazing to know that exists out there. And we've talked about those cards. Official thing was Carmen Sandiego, or at least Where in Time is Carmen Sandiego, did have trading cards. So I'm also on a trading card, which I thought was also coming full circle to me collecting all those movie cards. I didn't have to chew any more gum to get my own trading card.
Thank God.
I know. It'd be a gumless smile.
Well, Kevin, it's been great chatting with you, and again, great work on The Flash. As we're kind of getting toward the end here, I want to ask you, you know, we know everybody's had a tough year. Certainly, television production was shut down for a long time. So that was tough. So I'm glad you had some comic work to fall back on, but I want to focus on the positive here. Give the listeners and the fans, some kind of positives. And what are some of the highlights for you of 2020? I mean, it hasn't been all bad, right?
No, you know, what's funny is, as a writer, you know, my life hasn't really changed much. You know, we still sit in a room, you know, I'm just home,
right.
You know, you can write from wherever, which is a benefit to being a writer. Mostly this has affected me because I have a 10-year-old daughter and, you know, she's home all the time now and she's Zoom schooling, which I'm sure every parent out there knows that, you know, we no longer have careers. We're all just homeschooling now. Even if they have school, they need help with it and things like that. But, it's funny you say that because I was putting together a holiday calendar, which I do for the family at the end. And so I was scrolling through all the photos of 2020 and I reminded everybody, I said, guys, I know this has been a lousy year. I was like, but look at all the great things we did. You know, we found things to do that we maybe wouldn't have done had there not been a world pandemic. You know, oddly enough, we did travel. First, we traveled, you know, within our realms, within our 6 hours and stuff, and we did things, and we all became close-knit. And, you know, I think everybody out there, for good or for bad, you spend a lot more quality time with each other, you know? And granted, we all need a break.
Right.
But it was kind of going down the memory lane of 2020. I was like, oh, there's a lot of good things we did. Truth be told, we went to Turkey for a month to get away from it because we had friends there and they didn't have and Turkey had handled COVID kind of better than we did at the time.
Right.
We were going to stay on this island off of Turkey where there was no COVID. So once we got there, we felt secure and it was really remarkable. And, you know, I always talk to writers. They say, well, what's your advice? And I always have two, which is one is always write. Just keep writing because, you know, there's that theory, whether you've heard it or not, which is you need 10,000 hours of anything before you're good at that topic.
Yep.
And the other thing is expand your horizons, travel, read, watch movies, watch people, because the great writers are the ones who know more than just writing. You know, they know a lot of life experiences and you can bring them into your world and And a lot of times when I'm trying to figure out what my character is doing or what he's into, I like to do what I call peripheral writing, which is to stop looking at my script and think, what's going on in my life? What's happening over here that I'm not paying attention to? And with all the things that I do that you read in my bio, it kind of helps, because sometimes if I'm too focused on one thing, I can shift and be like, all right, let me spend time doing this acting thing or directing thing or whatever. And it always, always informs the writing, and not just the writing, but whatever I'm talking about is always informed by one of the other things. So it was no, you know, cosmically, it was no accident, I think, that I was asked to do The Flash towards the end of this year, because for me, Barry Allen was always about hope. And I entered it with hope. And now this comic has come out the same month that, you know, we're starting to see these vaccinations getting rolled out. So I'm just, I still have a lot of hope. I still have a lot of, what I want to say, this experience from this year that has changed me in better ways, made me appreciate things more, made me less scared to do things that I may not have done if it was in a different year. So yeah, I'm trying to look at the glass as half full.
Yeah, it's a great philosophy. And to your point about doing other things, you know, it's so true. And I think it's especially writers that are trying to break in, whether it's comics or something else, you're always told, you know, write, you got to, you know, work hard. But you can't forget to consume and recharge your batteries and take in things. It doesn't mean you're taking them in to regurgitate and copy something.
No.
But you need to be happy. You need to have that passion. You need to remember why you enjoy writing.
Exactly. Because like we said, you'll read and feel the enjoyment on the page. Because if you don't, you're not going to attract anybody.
Yeah.
And look, if you could read a Flash comic and learn something about the world, you know, there's a little science in there. You know, I did a lot of research, whether I needed to or not, I don't know. But I, you know, I went down a rabbit hole about the mythology of the Philosopher's Stone and all those things. And it was a great fun trip. You know, some of that comes on the page, but the other part is just in my brain that, you know, could be used somewhere else too. But I enjoyed myself. I was happy to learn something from this.
Yeah, exactly. And you'll take that experience with The Flash maybe to, you know, something you do in television, you know, three years from now, who knows?
Exactly. Who
knows? One last question, Kevin, and then I'll let you go. Sure. Holiday traditions, you know, you mentioned your 10-year-old daughter, your wife living there together. Any holiday traditions? You have the house all decorated. Is Christmas a big deal over there?
It is. My daughter loves it. And she's very specific about when we do things. And so we've already got our tree and we decorated that and we have the eggnog and we have, you know, we have the garland set up and the Christmas lights. For me, maybe because I am a child of the 70s and 80s, it's all about the Christmas television specials.
Gotcha.
So we've been trying to click one off, you know, every night if we can, which is a lot of fun. For those who don't know it, I was part of... they turned, you know, Elf with Will Ferrell was a movie. Then they turned it into a Broadway musical. And they took the music from that and made it into a hour-long animated stop-motion special.
Really?
And so it's called Elf Buddy's Musical Christmas. And it's actually pretty good. And I was at Warner Brothers when they were doing it. And I laid down the scratch track for all the roles. Because when you do stop-motion, you have to start early, long before you get the cast.
Right.
But I was able to keep some roles for myself by the time, you know, we went to final mix and all. So that was a lot of fun. And it's a really fun Christmas special. And it's, you know, the Will Ferrell one is fantastic. But if you're looking for something different, a little quicker, a little fun with stop motion, that's another one we've added to our list of Christmas specials that we look at every year.
Do you know where it's available for people to check it out?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I know it's on iTunes and you could probably also get it on Amazon. I think it's on most of the streaming ones. Although since it is Warner Brothers, you might want to check first the HBO Max because I think they have everything there, but it's called Elf Buddy's Musical Christmas.
Well, I'll definitely have to look for that. Any favorites, if you had to pick one holiday special from your childhood, one that's...
You know what? I think the definitive Christmas Carol is the one with George C. Scott and I watch it every year. And you talk about pop culture, that David Warner, who you've seen in Time Bandits and Star Trek and as Jack the Ripper and all these things, he plays Bob Cratchit. And I never have a dry eye when that is over. It's my favorite version of A Christmas Carol.
So that one's still on my list to watch for this year. I haven't seen it since I was a kid, and I'm actually watching about six different versions of The Christmas Carol this year. I always threaten to do it every year. Like, I need to figure out which one's my favorite.
I did that too. Years ago, I did that. I put them all together, and this is my favorite, the George C. Scott one.
Yeah, it's definitely on my list. I got about three to go. So
good. I'm always intrigued, or I was when I was watching them all and comparing them, how they deal with Jacob Marley, because he's one of my favorite characters. Mm-hmm. And I still remember, this is before probably, I was a kid, and I think they might have been before VCRs. So I remember staying up to like 1 a.m. to see what this old-timey version was. It wasn't the Alice Sim ones, I don't think. But one, I'm waiting, and when he comes in, Jacob Marley says, "Scrooge, only you can see me." And then you never saw him. You see a rocking chair just rocking back and forth for like 20 minutes. And I was like, what a cheap cop out. But it made me laugh.
That might be the 1935 version.
I think it might be. I think it might be.
Yeah, that one is not on my list.
I'll give you permission to skip that one.
Yeah, everything I read about it was, yeah, you don't really need to.
Yeah, I took that hit for the team. So as it goes, you're okay.
Great. Well, again, Kevin, it's been great to talk to you. I look forward to meeting you in person one day if we ever get conventions back on track.
I know. We will. Well, we will.
For fans and listeners who might not already be following you, who this is their first introduction, are you active on social media? Is there a place
where I am? I am at Kevin Shinnick, and Shinnick is Shinick. It's at Kevin Shinnick on Instagram, on Twitter. I have kevinshinnick.com as my website. And I think that's pretty much all the places that I am. Okay. And I have a professional page on Facebook is what I have too.
Fantastic. Well, I'll put links to the Twitter, Instagram, and Kevin's webpage on the show notes, everybody, so you can go there if you're having any trouble finding them. And from my family to yours, Kevin, have a wonderful holiday. Thank you so much for joining us. It was great to chat with you, hear about your career and your thoughts on writing. And again, just absolutely loved your run on The Flash.
So glad. And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. And have a happy holiday.
Yeah, thanks so much. And thanks to you all, listeners, for listening as always. We'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.